It must not be done, my dear Weldon. You must understand that, though I'm not a Christian Scientist, I'm a great believer in the power the mind holds over the body. Oh, a great believer in that. What is it that keeps strength in her now? Simply the thought that she is not seriously ill. We talk cheerfully together. We plan the trips and the rides that we soon will be able to take together. It is always just a few days, and then she will be up. I talk to her seriously of her good progress. How long has she been in bed? A few weeks now. And still she expects to be well almost any day? And yet she's not a fool, you would say, interpreted the doctor. Of course she's not. But hope is a blinding bandage across the eyes. Believe me, it is an opiate that puts the mind to sleep. She is filled with hope. That is why I never question her too closely about her sleepless nights. All is done with a light touch. I smile. I am very gay when I am with her. So we carry on the battle. But, he went on in a graver voice, if I begin to make midnight visits to her, she will grow suspicious, distressed. She will be concerned for you and me, keeping vigils for her sake. Then her nerves will begin to give way in real earnest. Believe me, my dear young man, when I tell you that we are dealing with a creature as delicate as gossamer, a soul as fragile as petals of flowers.
I do believe you, Weldon said, and I'll offer no more advice.
He was touched by this speech, although he could not help smiling at the thought of the old doctor being light-hearted. Mirth for Henry Watts would be like a song from an owl.
I would like to know, Weldon said, just how the general died. Was it a long illness?
The doctor shook his head. His face was sad.
Young man, he said a little impatiently, if it had been a long illness, he would have been able to tell us where he had put his property, I take it.
Weldon nodded.
A sudden death, then?
In the middle of the afternoon, in his chair in the library. You've noticed the big leather chair?
With a footrest before it?
That's it.
And he died there?
He'd spoken a word about a bad headache the day before.
That morning he remained in bed late.
Ah, if I had had a chance to talk with him about his symptoms.
But as a matter of fact, it irritated the general to have anyone suspect that he could be sick. He used to say that he had not spent 10 hours in bed between sunrise and sunset since he was a child. He never was sick. He refused to be.
He sighed and then went on. These men of iron, Mr. Weldon, I take it that you're one of the same caste yourself, in a way.
Not at all, Weldon answered. Next to being perfectly well, there's nothing better than a fever, say. Clouds floating across your mind, the world made into another place. Voices sound like waves breaking in a cave. No, I have enjoyed a good many sicknesses, and the best part is the convalescence, lying weak as water, your body shrunk, and an enormous appetite beginning to gnaw at the insides like a wolf.
He chuckled. You see, I'm the very opposite of the general. The doctor looked at him for a moment from beneath shaggy brows.
You're a strange young man, he said.
And the general's death?
No doubt he'd been weakening for months, but forcing himself on, keeping the iron mask before our eyes. You see, he was over 70.
But very fit, you said.
No one is fit at 70, answered the doctor with a touch of dryness. And the fool who tries to be a young man at that age kills himself with the effort.
Weldon was a little startled, but there were these flashes of unexpected bluntness in the doctor.
He did spend several hours after sunrise in his bed on that last day, went on Henry Watts. At lunch, I noticed that he wasn't eating much.
You were living here, then?
I used to come here for a shameless lot of meals. When I called the general's attention to the fact that he was not eating with appetite, he was angry. and forced a large meal down his throat.
You see the foolish pride of the man.
Then after lunch, when he should have lain down to rest, I suggested that he should. He snapped at me, and went into the library instead. No quiet reading for him. He picked up a history of the O'Malleys, a very stirring thing. Well, age, bad digestion, much too heavy a meal, weakness that had been increasing lately, and then the shock of the stirring narratives in that book, all those combined to strike him suddenly. He died in his chair. We found his head fallen on his chest. "He's sleeping," whispered Helen to me. "Dear Dad, how we'll tease him about this."
"We will," I said.
But after we were out of the room, I managed to slip back into it. I was not so sure about that sleep. There was something odd about the manner in which one hand was gripped and the other relaxed. I found him dead, and the body cold.
"His heart?" Weldon asked.
"No doubt about that. The heart cannot stand the strain of all the foolish things that people will insist on doing to it. The heart must break at last. Fray the strongest cable for 70 years, and at last even a small strain will make it burst." And yet it seemed impossible. I looked down at the bowed, dead head of the general. I could not believe that he was really gone from us. Even though I knew that his heart had stopped beating, I expected him to start up at any moment and laugh in my face, saying, "Death? Do you think I would surrender to death? Only for a moment, to show it that I despise it." I really expected the dead body to spring up.
You who do not know him cannot imagine his vitality.
In fact, the doctor was so thoroughly overcome by the memory of that tragic moment that he placed a hand before his face and steadied himself by resting the other hand on the back of a chair.
"And you're sure," asked Weldon, "that there was no foul play?"
"Foul play?" the doctor gasped, dropping his screening hand.
"Poison, say," suggested Weldon.
The doctor merely gaped.
"Of course I know nothing about such things. I merely make the suggestion."
"Good heavens!" whispered the doctor. He sank into the chair. He was so overcome by the horrible idea that he shook violently, and his lips parted and twitched.
"You see," Weldon explained, sorry for the shock that he had given Dr. Watts, "it seemed to me that it would be possible, and there would be a reason. Kill the general, so that the criminals would be left freer to search the house for the treasure they thought was in it. Then escape with the money that they found in that secret compartment you just have shown me. Afterward, they'd come back again."
"Damnation!" exclaimed Weldon, as the thought struck home to him.
"There was the case of the poison water for Helen O'Malley. You see how it fits in with the rest? They poisoned the general first. Now they return to see if they can't get some more spoil, and they're using the same methods in order to get rid of the poor girl."
"Are you right?" the doctor asked hollowly. "Can you be right? Ah, Weldon, right or wrong, you put a terrible burden on my soul. Suppose that crime was committed, and I in the house, under my very eyes, and I with professional skill thrown away."
He struck his hands heavily together and stared at the fire.
Then Weldon stood up from his chair and said quietly, "We've got to get Helen O'Malley away from this house."
"How?"
"We've got to have her moved. Let them rob the place. But let's keep her life. That's the main work."
"You'd kill her in 10 minutes, said the doctor, "by even suggesting such a thing."
"She's not as fragile as that, I hope," answered Weldon.
"Phew!"
cried the doctor. His excitement was growing great.
"I tell you," Weldon said, "this gloomy old place and the memory of her father constantly coming back to her mind while she's in it are enough to throw a strong man off balance, let alone a girl like her. She's got to have a change of place and a change of air."
"Good heavens," breathed the doctor. "Do you mean that you'd argue the point with her?"
"Would? I mean that I will."
"I tell you," Dr. Watts said,
I forbid such a mad attempt. My dear Helen, my poor child, to be torn away from the house, taken I don't know where, the fatigue of the journey would kill her. Or if not, to miss the things she has grown up with, to be placed in some sanitarium. Horrible, horrible. Weldon, I know you mean well, but I repeat to you, as a doctor, with all my professional weight, I forbid such a thing.
Weldon looked earnestly at him. No doubt Watts meant the best in the world for Helen O'Malley. But suddenly it struck Weldon that it would be very odd if this man, so long divorced from active practice, should still retain any great ability as a physician. There was a great deal of talk constantly on his lips about nerves, tenderness, shock, and other outmoded catchphrases. In that moment, Weldon resolved that he would see to it that other medical advice should be called in. Chapter 17. He determined that at least there was nothing to be gained by antagonizing the good doctor. He saw that worthy man from the house and said good night to him. The doctor was very much troubled. He held Weldon's hand for a moment in both his.
"I have angered you, Weldon," he said anxiously. "I've upset you. You feel that I'm tyrannical, that I perhaps am making great mistakes. Perhaps. I pray that I am not. Only I must do what conscience and my professional experience tell me is best."
Weldon said very heartily, "Doctor, I assure you I have every faith in your conscience." He did not say, "in your skill," but the doctor seemed relieved and went off with his rather rapid, fumbling stride. Weldon, watching him disappear, felt a touch of pity. He never saw the back of the old doctor, in fact, without a touch of that same emotion. For his own part, he softly went around the house again. He did not try those dark, cold, reeking lower passages, but he toured around on the outside. He could not help feeling that it would be impossible to spy out the approach of skulkers toward the house. They had ample cover from the trees, and where the trees left off, rocks that jutted out commenced. He himself would have guaranteed reaching the place, even if 100 eyes constantly scanned all the ground about the house. He went on carefully through the dark, completed the tour, and came to the rear of the patio wall, just as a thin sickle of moon sailed out from among the clouds and floated for a moment in the mysterious black sea of heaven. At the same time, something glistened on the side of the mountain above him. He jerked himself about to face it, and saw merely the glinting of some smoothly polished columns under the pale moonshine. He was surprised at that. He had not noticed such a structure before when he came to the house in the sunlight, but at that time he had been directing all his attention to the house and the patio itself. He went up the hill to the gleaming columns. There were four of them, plain Doric affairs of granite, the transporting to this place of which must have cost a bit of money. They held up a roof, or a pseudo-roof. As a matter of fact, except for the columns, the place consisted of the dark rock of the mountain of Los Altos itself. This had been cut away, and when Weldon turned his bull's eye into the place, he saw at once what it was. A deep hollow had been chiseled into the face of the mountain, the columns inserted for the sake of supporting the entrance, or merely for ornament, and behind the columns there was a rather pretty scrollwork of partially gilded iron to keep intruders, man or beast, from the interior. That interior contained a plain stone sarcophagus, undecorated except for a roll at either end. It was the tomb of the general, of course. It looked so fresh and newly done that Weldon felt as though the old man must have been closed within that ponderous lid hardly the day before. Then he returned back to the house, entered, and went softly up the stairs to his room. It was 3 a.m., and the rest of that night he spent in the library reading. It was not a pleasant session at the best, with the wind occasionally stooping from the cold heart of the sky and crying out about the building. and his eyes grew heavy from following the print. At last he lay back and fastened his mind on the problem, for though he had no idea of trying to solve the thing by sheer inspiration, he wanted the facts to be ordered in his mind. For this reason, he restated everything, and came to the odd conclusion that Francesca LaGuardia was responsible for his presence in the O'Malley house at that moment. But then his train of reasoning was not entirely absurd. It was her dark and lovely face, her musical voice, which had started his heart beating at an unusual rate, and that, in turn, had made him look about for diversion, diversion that he found in heavy gambling in Cabrera's place, and the exploits at Cabrera's place, in turn, brought him to the notice of the good doctor, and the doctor brought him up the hill to the new adventure. So he reverted to Francesca LaGuardia, and wondered if he ever would see her again. He felt an odd surety that he would. No doubt she lived in the midst of dangers of the gun and the law, to say nothing of reckless automobile driving, and yet he was oddly sure that their trails would cross again. In jail, perhaps, Weldon murmured to himself, smiling. In the meantime, he had much to try to learn here. He wanted to push, if he could, the inquiry as to the manner in which the general had died. There was one fairly sure way of finding out. They could exhume the body. He remembered gruesome tales of bodies dead for 10 years, in which the presence of poison had been detected. Arsenic poisoning in every case, he thought it had been. Suppose he could prevail upon the doctor to have the body ordered out of the grave. The thing might be managed without letting Helen O'Malley learn of it. He nodded grimly to himself as he arrived at that step in his plans. In the second place, he could only hope that he would be able to entrap the next visitors to the house of O'Malley. With this in mind, he found that the dawn had come. It made a rich picture from the window as he turned the shutters back. The Rio Negro quite belied its dark name and became a river of fire. The windows of the two towns blinked at him like crimson lightning again and again, and gradually the rose faded from the sky, and the strong sun sailed up the height. Aunt Maggie came not long afterward. She paused with her broadest grin on her way to the room of Helen O'Malley. "You ain't no sleeper, sir," she said. Weldon retired to a bathroom to bathe and shave. When that was finished, he found breakfast waiting, and he ate it with a grand appetite. Matters seemed better to him this morning. The sun lifts the veil from our minds and carries away despondency. He finished his coffee, smoked his cigarette, and hailed Aunt Maggie on her way back from the sick room. She herself would take a letter for him when she went down to the market with her mule and cart. So he sat at the library table and wrote the message. "Dear Ben, come up to see me at once at the O'Malley house. You will find out in San Trinidad or Juniper where the place is. Bring along your medical kit, please, if you have one with you. If not, buy a new one. I mean stethoscope, thermometer, and your apparatus for taking blood pressure. I have a patient here for you. Come fast." He sealed the envelope and wrote on the outside, "Dr. Benjamin Wilbur," and put down the name of the hotel in San Trinidad. He was reasonably sure that Wilbur would be at the place by this time. They had appointed a tryst for which Wilbur had been overdue even the day before. He was a rare fellow, this Wilbur, doubtless as complete a scoundrel as any man that ever walked in shoes, and with a criminal ability that ranged from cracking safes to picking pockets. But he was a pleasant companion, always amusing, usually walking on the heels of some rare adventure, and when Weldon was in his chronic state of hunger for excitement, he was apt to call on Wilbur, as he had not long before, and asked for this appointment. But in addition to his other qualities, Wilbur was a remarkable physician. Weldon himself had seen operations performed by him in the wilderness, delicate operations when Wilbur had no more than a hunting knife and a pair of wire tweezers and a common needle and thread. He knew the human body and the frailties of the human mind, this educated crook, and this was a place where he could show his talents. Weldon felt that he was stepping a little behind the back of Watts in sending off this letter, but he was willing to overstep the bounds of politeness far more than this, if he could do good to the sick girl. Then his bell rang, and he went in to see her. She was in her chair beside the window, her hands and the pages of her book in dazzling sun, her face half lost in the upturned collar of a bed jacket. Had he slept well? Yes, very well. And she? She had had a good night, thanks to him, knowing that he was so near and that no harm could come to her. Had she been upset because of the way in which he broke down the door of her chamber? No. On the contrary, that was what had made her feel so secure. And her eyes looked at his hands, and then slowly turned up to his face, and she smiled at him like a child, with trust. But as he left the room again, he heard a softly stifled yawn, and knew that she had done what the doctor predicted, lain awake all night. And now she would sleep, if she could, in the warm comfort of the sun. Chapter 18. A little after midday, Wilbur arrived. Weldon, drowsing after luncheon, wakened at the sound of the man's step in the hall. He thought at first it was the old doctor, who had not made his appearance as yet. But after a moment, he knew that Dr. Watts never could have moved with such a cadence. Aunt Maggie brought the stranger to the library door and stood aside with the look of a watchdog until she saw Weldon take the newcomer's hand. Wilbur was drawn in, the door closed. They sat down beside a window and examined each other with faint smiles. They had been through much together. They were not really friends, but theirs was a mutual respect, and behind them lay much history that each had shared with the other. "Is this game worthwhile, Lou?" asked the doctor. "Ben, my boy," said Weldon, "this isn't a game. It's a three-ringed circus." "You have to watch the three rings all at once, eh?" "I have to, if I can. But this show is all in the dark, and I'm straining my eyes to find out what's happening." "Do I step in?" "You stay out," Weldon said with decision. "There's no real need for your talents here, my boy." "But this?" Wilbur touched with his hand the little Morocco case that he carried. "Two rooms from this, there's a girl ill with consumption," Weldon explained. "You're to see her for me. Mind you, you're simply here to pay me a friendly visit. I hope that you will be allowed to examine her. You understand? She's a delicate thing." "How delicate?" asked Wilbur. "In every way. The brave kind, my boy." "Beautiful, of course," the doctor said, showing a fine white set of teeth as he smiled. He would have been remarkably handsome, except for the extreme height of his forehead, which made his entire face seem rather elongated. "I've only seen one woman more beautiful," said Weldon. "Then she can't be so delicate as all that," Wilbur replied. "Beauty is a light, Lou. It doesn't shine from burned-out lamps." Weldon brushed this idea quickly to one side. "You're going to revise your ideas of women when you meet her." "Is this a rich marriage, Lou?" asked the other, calmly turning his head and noting the contents of the room. "She is going to die," Weldon said, leaning a bit forward. The doctor nodded, unmoved. "I mean to say," explained Weldon, "the old fellow who's taking care of her believes that she'll never get out of this decline. A grand old man he is, but probably half a century behind the times in his medical ideas. Wilbur, if you save her, I—" He paused. "As much as all that," Wilbur said with his cynical smile. "More," said Weldon. The other nodded with a brightening eye. "I'll do my best for her," he said. "As a matter of fact, I wouldn't miss a chance of doing you a serious good turn. It is bound to come back to me later on. I'm a gold digger, you know." He waved an airy hand, but Weldon knew that, in fact, it was a confession of faith. "And I have been brought down here for this, Lou?" "You have, for this job only. I'm sorry." Tush! It's nothing! Go ahead and prepare my way." So Weldon went to the sick room and tapped on the door. A sleepy voice told him to enter. He apologized for disturbing Miss O'Malley, but it had happened by a rare chance that an old friend of his had come to visit him, a truly great doctor. Would she let the physician see her? She opened her eyes and looked up as though she were greatly frightened.
"Do you think I need any doctor other than dear Dr. Henry, Mr. Weldon?"
"Of course, Dr. Watts will cure you, but here's a fellow who might show you a shortcut. And after all, don't you owe it to yourself to take every chance?"
She closed her eyes to think. "You're kind," she said. "If Dr. Watts could be asked about it first?"
Weldon bit his lip. It was exactly the thing that he had feared. "Very well," he said, "but Wilbur is staying only a short time."
"Won't you introduce him to me, at least? Then afterward, if Dr. Watts—"
Weldon went back to his friend. "You're to be allowed to sit in her presence for a little while," he said, "but the old fossil has to be consulted before you examine her. Come with me and be agreeable, Wilbur. Wipe the sneer off your face and off your mind. Will you try to do that?" He took Wilbur into the sick room. Helen O'Malley lay in peace and smiled at the new medical man with perfect trust, while Wilbur led off smoothly and pleasantly with talk about Los Altos and the southern mountains and weird burro trails that he had followed among them. Weldon thought that he managed it very well, and he was surprised and disappointed when, at the end of a half hour, Wilbur announced that he must not tire the patient. He promptly retreated to Weldon's room, where the latter said grimly, "You were just beginning to win her confidence, man. What do you mean by breaking off the talk like that before you had a chance to—" Wilbur raised his hand. "I was there long enough to find out all that I wanted to find out."
"You were?"
"I was."
"You know what's wrong with her, then? Do you really know, Wilbur?"
Instead of answering at once, Wilbur looked long at his companion. "And you don't know?" he asked sharply at length.
"I? I'm not a doctor. How should I know?"
Wilbur dropped into silence again, walking rapidly up and down the room. "It's serious, of course," suggested Weldon, following the other with gloomy eyes. Wilbur shrugged his shoulders.
"It's fatal, man?" went on Weldon.
The doctor spun about, dropped his hands into his coat pockets, and stared again at Weldon.
"I'm not the patient," said Weldon. "Don't act as though you were studying a disease in me."
"Come clean with me," the doctor said.
"You're in love with this girl?"
"I? No," he answered slowly, looking carefully into his mind.
"I see," Wilbur said, and began to pace the room again.
"You see what?" snarled Weldon.
"But you're serious about this?"
"Entirely.
Don't be so mysterious. Tell me at once. Can anything be done for this poor girl?"
Wilbur considered again, but once more he shook his head.
"Not by me," he said. "I couldn't help her."
"Does that mean that nobody could help her?"
"No, it doesn't mean that."
"Benjamin, I'm within an ace of chucking you through that window," cried Weldon. He added, "Will you talk out to me?"
He was astonished to hear the other say calmly, "No, I won't talk out to you. I've said every word that I intend to say about her and her case."
"Will you tell me why?"
"I am not a Sir Galahad or a King Arthur," Wilbur said. "However, I'm a doctor, and there is such a thing as professional etiquette."
He shut his teeth together with a snap, and Weldon, angry and confused, realized that there was no more to be had from him on that subject. He turned suddenly to another theme.
"Very well, then. We'll let that drop. But tell me another thing. Is it difficult to discover if a man has died of poison?"
"It depends on the kind, and how long the man has been dead."
"Say arsenic, and dead 1 year."
"Perfectly simple," said the other.
"You're sure?"
"Yes."
"Then go back to Juniper," Weldon said, "and return here after dark. Come as silently as a thief. Will you do that?"
"To make an autopsy, man?
Yes. Wait a moment, Lou. Do you mean to open a grave?
I mean just that.
It's a horrible business, Wilbur said slowly.
Listen to me, Weldon said. If it's horrible for you, do you think it's not 10 times more horrible for me?
True, the other nodded.
You'll come then?
I can't refuse you anything, Lou. But I would like to ask...
Ask nothing, not a word.
Very well.
I'll expect you an hour or so after sunset. No, make it 11 o'clock.
Dr. Wilbur sighed. Friends, he said at last, are expensive luxuries. Goodbye.
He left at once to ride back to Juniper, and Weldon watched him away. He was almost inclined to call back Wilbur at the last moment, for he was committing them to a course of action that might ruin them both. However, he finally snapped his fingers and turned away. Every nerve in his body was jumping. For what had Wilbur, in 15 minutes, seen in Helen O'Malley? What was the thing that professional courtesy kept him from mentioning?
Chapter 19 When Dr. Watts arrived later that afternoon, Weldon told him at once of the coming of his friend Wilbur, and the old man listened earnestly.
"Heaven forgive me," he said, "if I should not see that everything possible is done for Helen. Send for the doctor again."
But Weldon excused himself. It was improbable, he said, that he could get Wilbur out to the house again.
"Did he see Helen while he was here?" asked Watts.
"He did, for a few minutes."
"And what did he make of her?"
Watts asked, looking fixedly at Weldon.
"Nothing," said Weldon. "Of course, he simply sat and chatted."
"Sat and chatted," Watts muttered.
"Sat and chatted?
And he made nothing of the case? Tell me, Weldon, is this fellow really a good doctor?"
"A wonderful doctor," Weldon said with conviction.
"He made nothing of her,"
Dr. Henry Watts said half to himself.
"Ah."
He kept on nodding for a moment, as though this were a most extraordinary thing. It increased the bewilderment of Weldon almost to the point of expression, but he resolutely kept silence. There was about Helen O'Malley something extraordinary that, to the professional eye of a doctor, revealed information of the greatest importance. In fact, Wilbur had thought it strange, apparently, that Weldon himself had not detected it, even with an unprofessional eye. What could it be? He strained his mind at the problem. Watts went on to see his patient, and Weldon followed him to the door of the room, in time to see the greeting, in time to hear her asking eagerly if he thought it a good thing that she should be seen by the new doctor.
"By all means," Watts said, "if Weldon can get him up here again. Ah, my dear, you should have let him look you over even while I was away, because two heads are better than one, eh? There are shortcuts to a complete cure at times."
Weldon, having heard enough, went back to doze in his chair in the library. He was much relieved when he discovered that Watts was not so narrow-minded as to wish to keep the care of the patient entirely to himself. But what was it that struck Wilbur so forcibly? The beauty of the girl, of course, her pathos, too, her shadowed, wearied eyes as well. But what beyond? So much that Wilbur had not credited that Weldon himself had not seen the thing. He determined that if Wilbur did come that night, he would tax him more closely, and try to get at the meaning of his odd remarks and his still more odd attitude. But when the meeting actually took place, other things drove that question from Weldon's mind. Well before the appointed time, he was waiting, walking impatiently up and down. The faint sound of crunching pine needles halted him, expectant. From beneath the trees, the tall form of Wilbur stepped. He looked calmly about him, even as he came forward.
"What nights you have up here," said the doctor. "What nights, eh, for a man in love?"
"We'll take our poetry a little later," Weldon said. "Have you everything?"
"I hope so."
He showed his case of instruments. "I need a strong light, Lou."
"I have one here. It will throw strong light for an hour."
That's time enough. Are you ready?
Ready as can be.
He led the way up the hill toward the dimly revealed columns of the tomb of the general. At the gate, he paused and fell to work on the lock with several long, strangely formed keys.
"How much danger of being watched at this game, old fellow?" asked Wilbur cheerfully.
"About 2 chances out of 3 of being caught." The doctor whistled.
"That's cheerful," he said. "However, how's the tomb arranged?"
"I found out today from the cook. There's a top slab of stone. Under that is a plain coffin of thin sheets of granite, and the body is inside that, wrapped in lead."
"No metal clamps to hold down the outer cover?"
"It makes no difference. I have a saw here that will go through them as though they were butter and not iron at all."
"Sing-ho!" Wilbur smiled. "You always were a clever fellow, Weldon."
The door presently gave under the manipulations of Weldon, and he pushed it wide with a careful touch.
"Good silent hinges, even on a grave," Wilbur observed. "And that I call the height of luxury. Let me have that light a moment, will you?"
Weldon passed it to his companion, who sent a ray of the light on one of the hinges, touched it, and rubbed his fingertips together.
"Quite so," said the doctor. "They've been oiling this hinge, old fellow. By gad, they make things convenient for ghosts here. Or ghouls, should I say?"
Weldon snatched the light and stared at the hinge in turn. The oil had been put on with care. Only by closely looking could one see a faint gleam, and then it rubbed off as grease on his fingertips.
"Black, too," observed the doctor. "So careful to keep everything right that they've even gone the length of blackening the oil so that it would look like a stain on the iron. Who takes care of these gates?"
Silently, Weldon went ahead. He passed under the canopy of the tomb. He stood beside the long, ponderous sarcophagus. "Hold the light," he said briefly, and then laid hold of one end of the topmost slab. It was a ponderous weight, but it yielded at once to his strength of arm. The lantern was held ready by his companion, and as the stone moved, he darted a ray inside.
"Empty," he said. "Quite hollow, old boy."
Weldon replaced the lid. He turned slowly away, and without a word they left the grave and returned to the dark shadow of the trees.
"Someone went before us," Wilbur murmured cheerfully. "Oiled the gate to keep it from screeching, and having cut through the iron clamps that held the upper slab in place, they took out the body. And where are we, Lou? Can you tell me?"
"Was it done recently or long ago?" asked Weldon.
"Recently, of course. That oil hasn't been there more than 24 hours. It hasn't had a chance to thicken up yet."
"Recently," murmured Weldon. "And someone has guessed that I might come out here. Somebody has been here before me, and the place has been rifled so that I won't have a chance to find out the secret of the general's death."
"It looks very much like it."
"Darn your smooth, smug way," Weldon yawned. He stretched himself and yawned again. "I like it better and better," he said.
"You do? I confess, if I were in your boots, I'd like it less and less. Someone's watching you and reading your mind, old-timer. And if he can read your mind, he's clever enough to make all manner of trouble for you."
"Of course he is," Weldon agreed. "But suppose I play my game in my own way. Let the fellow catch me if he can. That's what I propose."
"Cold steel in the hollow of your back, Lou. Think it over. Is it worthwhile? Would 10 like her be worth the price?"
"Don't read my mind," Weldon protested dryly. "Leave that for the man who opened this grave today."
"By Jove, it must have been today."
"Of course it was. And that means this evening."
Weldon muttered softly. "I'm going back."
"To the tomb?"
"Yes."
"Tell me. Do you need me any longer?"
"Not a bit. Can I let you have money? Are you short?"
"Your money would do me no good. There's not enough of it. So long, Lou."
"How long are you here?"
"Until I hear from you."
"That may be never."
"Ah, well," the cheerful doctor said, "a man has to take the chances as they come to him. So long again."
Chapter 20 Wilbur went lightly down the hill, and Weldon, instead of going at once to the grave, as he had announced that he would, slipped softly through the trees behind the tall doctor. He had had a definite reason for wishing to send Wilbur away. It was no formed and solid thought, but a suspicion, which he wished to follow out. It was a fair night overhead. The moon was not yet up, but the bright multitude of the stars gave a faint light. The wind did not stir, but the fragrance of the pines floated down in silent rain, drenching the air. Weldon took heed of all this as he slipped along behind his friend, for his mind could not be so occupied that his senses failed to perceive all that was around him. The doctor, with a good deal of cunning, had lodged his horse below the house and to the left of it, in a thick growth of trees. To this place Weldon softly followed him, and saw him untether and mount the animal. Nothing stirred around him. Weldon himself crouched low in the shadow of the brush, and he watched keenly, seeing that the doctor was safely getting away. Well mounted, he left the trees. The soft sound of the footfall of the horse, taking off at a walk, was quickly out of the ears of the listener, and then a form slipped from the brush just opposite him and started up the slope in the direction of the house. Joy shot through the heart of Weldon, and for the first time he felt that he had his hand on some thread of the quiet mystery that lay in the atmosphere of the place. The form drew closer in passing. A woman! He stepped like a panther after her and took her from behind by the elbows. It was like putting hands on a wildcat. Twice she almost had writhed herself free. Twice he tightened his grip. At last she stood still. "You're breaking my arms," she said quietly. It was the first sound she had made. Afterward she was quiet again, panting a little. Her hair had fallen down. It rushed in a great wave over her shoulders, and the ray of a star glistened on it. Weldon did not relax his grip, but waited a moment, thinking. "Who are you?" he asked. She was silent. He had a sailor's habit of carrying knife and twine, without which a man is hardly a man aboard a ship. So first he worked his hold down to her wrists, slender, round, strong. He shifted both wrists into one hand, and he cautioned her gravely, "If you try to tear free now, I'll snap the bones like pipe stems. I mean that, my dear." Whatever she thought of the threat, she stood still, while he worked the strong twine around and around the wrists, binding them inextricably together. Then he freed her. "Face me," Weldon ordered. She turned toward him. "Will you tell me now who you are?" He hardly waited for the answer that he knew he would not get, and sent a flash from the bull's eye across her face. Francesca LaGuardia. Even those iron nerves of Weldon were a little unstrung. And then horror stiffened him. "Who else is here with you?" he asked her.
"No one."
"You've sent them away, then, have you?" She did not answer. "Before we go into the house," he said, "I'm going to ask you what brought you here." Again she was silent. "Of course, it's a good game," Weldon said, "dumb when the questions come. It's the right game, as a rule. But I'm not a common dick. I knew you were crooked, my dear, the first moment I saw you. I've heard bits about you since, and they all point the same way. But until this moment, I didn't guess what a pure breed of wildcat you are. Is that right, Francesca? Is there any streak of good in you?" He chuckled at the thought that she might answer such a question. Then he said gravely, "As a matter of fact, Francesca, there is something to be gained if you'll confess to me. I'm not ordinarily a stone, so far as a pretty girl is concerned. I take a good deal of interest in pretty girls. A great deal of interest in them, as a matter of fact. And you're beautiful enough, my dear, to open my heart. I can't help wanting to go easily with you. I don't want to throw you into jail. I don't want to fit a rope around that soft little throat of yours." He paused to let these ideas become planted in her mind, and then he continued more harshly, But, my dear, it is very true that unless you give me information, a ton of it, Francesca, I'm going to do all those things. I'm going to take you down to the jail, and I'm going to sit in front of your door to see that you don't get away, and I'm going to see that justice is done on you. Unless you give me a chance to do justice on your friends. He waited. Still, there was no answer from Francesca LaGuardia. Anger began to rise in Weldon. He stepped a little closer to her so that the fragrance of her was in his nostrils, mixed with the pure sweetness of the pines. He snapped on the bull's eye and sent a strong shaft flooding upward across his face and hers. She was so close that they were almost touching, but there was no real fear in those shining black eyes of hers. Instead, busy thought was filling them. Actively, her keen young brain was turning and twisting for a way to escape, just as her body had been turning and twisting a moment before in his grip. "Look at me, beauty," he said. "Do I have the look of meaning what I say? Do I have the look of a fellow who will be able to push himself through to the finish of a deal? Can I be cruel? Could I harden my heart against Helen of Troy, even? Look at me, my dear, and then tell me what you think." Long and straight was the glance with which she probed his eyes, his mind even, and then her eyes closed. It was answer enough, and he snapped out the light with a harsh little laugh. "You're right, Francesca," he said. "I'm a brute and a bully, and I'll treat you exactly like a man, unless you choose to talk to me." He heard her draw a breath and knew that she was weakening.
"About what must I talk?" she asked him faintly.
"One moment, and I'll show you. Come with me." He kept two fingers on her arm. It was true that she could not run away from him, and her tied hands could do nothing against him, but still he felt much safer when he was actually in touch with her. He guided her beneath the face of the house, and through the trees, and toward the tomb upon the hillside. He expected that she would hold back, but she did not attempt to resist. Straight up to the gate of the tomb he led her, and then said sternly, "Francesca, what I do with you depends entirely on your frankness with me. Tell me from the shoulder. Who was it that helped you to open that gate, and cut the irons that held the upper slab, and steal the body out of the grave?" She had been as steady as a rock up to that moment. Now she gasped quickly and reeled a little. He supported her, looking down keenly in the starlight, for he was reasonably sure that she was merely shamming. But there was something about her quick gasping for breath that convinced him. She was disturbed in all truth now. "Good," Weldon said. "A hard young woman you are, Francesca. When I first met you, I thought that you were simply a clever thief, a grand smuggler, a daredevil at the wheel of a car, and a very successful worker of men. But when I found out that murder and the rest were on your list as well, why, it dampened my spirits a little, Francesca. But now I begin to think that you may almost have a streak of conscience in you. Is that right, my dear? And if it is right, will you talk out and tell Papa all about this grave robbing?" She said faintly,
"I'll tell you everything. I'll talk. I'll tell you everything. But will you give me a little moment to...
"Steady, steady," he said. "All the time in the world. No hurry, Francesca. Just walk up and down with me. Then we'll begin to open up the subject." Chapter 21 The moon came up suddenly as he walked her back and forth on the little level stretch before the tomb, so he led her back to the woods. Here, in a long, narrow clearing, they passed back and forth into deep shadow, and then again into the pale shining of the moon, by which he could see her face doubly pale and her eyes doubly large and dark. He talked to her carelessly of herself while he waited for her to grow calmer. "I feel as if I know you very well, Francesca," he said. "I feel as though we'd walked this same ground before. Sentimentally walked back and forth and admired the moon and the trees and other things.
I feel that we've been very fond of one another. I feel as if I've seen your face many times. But that's true of all the beauties. They open the heart and give one something important to think about. They connect one with great thoughts, great crimes, great follies, great tragedies, great mercies. Nothing small should come from a woman with a face like yours. So that I'm glad, my dear, that you're in harmony. A soul as big as the soul of a man inside, and the beauty of an angel outside. It makes the picture good. How many things could ruin you? A voice like the voices of chorus girls, a foolish laugh, a loose tongue, contemptible vices. But you have none of those things. You're all made of one piece. You are, in fact, a grand girl, Francesca. Sweet, sweet Francesca. Sweet poison. How much better to have you, even the demon that you are, than to have you an innocuous little fool. In fact, my dear, clearly as I began to see behind the scenes, into the darkness that might be called Francesca's soul, I could be in love with you. Mad with love. Drunk with love. I could build pyramids or wreck jails for Francesca. However, I know of a flower that I hold up before my eyes, and it makes me safe from you. It makes me free of care completely. She that lies in the house yonder. Do you know her, Francesca? Answer me, because I'm curious. I know her, Francesca said faintly. Are you feeling better now? Yes. But before we begin the other thing, tell me if you ever saw her face to face. Yes, I've seen her face to face. And she saw you? No, not exactly. Are you being honest? Yes, I think I am. She was going past me, absent-minded, but I was watching for her like a hawk. Good, Weldon said, like a hawk. Of course, you're always like a hawk, always really fierce. Do you ever soften, Francesca? Does anything ever cause you to open your heart? Why do you ask me? Said the girl. Isn't it a fair question? She was silent, but she raised her head a little, and he knew that she was staring angrily at him. A moment ago, he said, I thought that even Francesca, even terrible and grim Francesca, might be touched if she were to meet that dying girl in the house yonder. But now I see that I was wrong. She can melt steel, but she couldn't melt Francesca. The girl broke in sharply. You're talking a great deal of nonsense. If you have something to get out of me, will you come to the point? Thank you, he said. I needed a touch of the whip. Now I'll try to keep the running fast and straight. In the first place, since we're working on the task of finding out all about these matters from the beginning, you had a hand in the killing of the general?
No, no,
the girl said. Weldon listened, amazed. There was a burst of real emotion, real horror and disgust in that soft cry. He did not dream of doubting her. You had no hand in the actual killing of the general, then?
No,
she repeated with a shudder. But afterward, you came into this job?
Yes.
When you first saw the girl and she first saw you, that was when you entered?
Yes.
You had been looking about for her? So as to see what you could do with her?
Yes.
Now go on from that point, please. Who asked you to start on this business?
No one, said the girl.
How can that be possible? Weldon cried. The general was killed. You had no hand in it. But afterward you came into the case all by yourself?
Yes, she said.
You admit that he was killed with poison?
He heard the slight catch of her breath, and he went on.
But though you had nothing to do with that, you helped the murderers to steal the body away from the grave tonight? You knew that I suspected the murder and that I intended to have a private autopsy performed. You knew that?
No.
Come, come, Weldon said. Then why were you out here tonight?
It's useless for me to tell you. You're sure not to believe what I say.
Try me, my dear girl. I will stretch every point in your favor if you like.
I've been interested in this old house for a long time," said Francesca.
"Good," he commented dryly. "Artistic interest? Or did you want a quiet place for your old age?"
"Very well," Francesca said. "If you intend to scoff at everything I say from the beginning, you may go on with the scoffing, but I'll not go on with the talking."
"You're right," he confessed. "I know you're right. Will you strike ahead then, Francesca? Tell your own story, straight out and uninterrupted. But if I find you lying, I'll start you for real misery on earth, because that's what prison life would be for you."
"No," said the girl. "You never could keep me in prison."
"You're the clever lass who would melt your way out, is that it?"
"My life is always my own," she said.
And though she said it quietly, he knew that she meant it. It gave him a little touch of awe and respect for her. He even bowed to his prisoner.
"Francesca," he said, "I salute you. Continue."
"I told you that I was interested in this house in the beginning. The reason was that I wanted a place where we could arrange easy deposits of loads brought over the frontier. In the old cellars up here, we could dump shiploads, and they'd never be found. And a couple of safe men could guard them here. Then we could work from this side, distributing. This could be our shipment headquarters for goods going into Mexico, too."
"That's neat and probable," he said.
"There was no one in the house except the girl," Francesca went on. "I wondered how I could get her out of the place."
"And then you had a clever thought. Slow poison, eh?"
She started, but instantly she laughed, and the sound was quiet music under the trees.
"I am all evil to you," she said.
He was rather taken aback by her calm. She had regained entire possession of herself.
"Go on," he directed, rather ashamed of his suggestion.
"I didn't want to harm her. First I wondered if the place could be bought, but she's a fool. She put a sentimental value on the house and wouldn't take money for it."
"Poor girl."
"Well, I wanted to play fair with her, Lou."
"You know that name of mine?"
"Yes, I know all about you." She said it shortly, as though the information were not of much importance. "But since I couldn't have the house by fair means, I made up my mind that I'd frighten her away. Ghosts, strange appearances, that sort of thing."
"Ah."
"So I sent up some of the boys to just let themselves be seen drifting about in the interior, to do something weird, if they could manage it."
"And that poor girl, an invalid. Go on."
"They were both spotted. Dios mio, what young fools they were."
"Are you Italian?" Weldon asked.
"When they had both failed," went on Francesca LaGuardia, leaving that last question unanswered, "I thought it would be a good idea if I tried my own hand. There are little tricks of making oneself up."
"You were going to show yourself to her, were you?"
"That was my idea. I came up the hill, and on the way I heard someone coming. I slipped behind some brush. It was a man who got on a horse and rode away. After he had gone, I started on for the house, and I hadn't made 10 steps before you had me."
"That's the full truth?"
"Yes."
"And what was your makeup to be?"
"There's a little metal box in the pocket of my jacket."
He found it, opened it, and the cold light of phosphorus was seen.
"Done up in this stuff, you would have killed her," Weldon said. "Go on." His anger was coming back.
"That's all there is to tell."
"How would you have got to her?"
"Not through your barred windows."
"You know about them?"
"Of course. While you were in the library, I intended to open the door of your room, get to the girls, and slip in. After that?"
"When she screamed?"
"Sounds won't carry from her room to the library."
"You simply would have slipped out again?"
"I would have tried to."
"How would you have opened my door?"
"I have a key."
"Where?"
"In the same pocket."
He found it and flashed the light on it. His careful eye could remember the pattern, and it was identical with his door key. Certainly her story was hanging together.
"What spies did you use to learn all this?"
"No spy at all."
"Be careful, Francesca."
"I am careful. I'm telling the truth. The negress can't keep from talking. When she goes down to market, she lets everything out about what's going on in the house."
Weldon bit his lip. Certainly it was very possible. "You had nothing to do with the removal of the body of old Malik tonight?"